The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Give you an account of a particular discourse of the Buddha called the Dutta Vibhanga Sutta. In English, it's translated as the Exposition on the Elements. It's a kind of very interesting discourse that contains a number of very interesting things kind of packed in together. And it's an account, you can approach this in different ways, but it involves a story, and the story involves the Buddha giving a Dharma talk, giving a talk, teaching to someone, probably the early morning hours. So the kind of setting is kind of special. If you're able to visualize, imagine the setting, this is the story. There was a man, some people think he was an elderly man, who had heard about the Buddha and was so inspired by what he heard and the teachings of the Buddha that someone had told him, that he decided that he would go off to follow the spiritual path, the Buddhist path, be ordained by the Buddha. And so he set off across India towards where the Buddha was, where he thought the Buddha was. And now this is an ancient world, and there were no IMCs down the street. There were no retreat centers people can go to. There were no books to be had. And so if you were serious about doing any kind of spiritual practice, it wasn't like just go down to, the local bookstore and buy a book and read some nice teaching, or go on the web, look it up. You don't have to leave your house now. But you had to often kind of rearrange your whole life in order to be able to do any kind of serious study or practice. So this man, this is what he was doing, getting ready to do, heading to where the Buddha, he thought the Buddha was. But as it turned out, the Buddha was out, not where he had been, but was traveling around. And one evening, the Buddha came to a potter's house, and he asked the potter, said, I'm traveling around, and would it be all right if I spent the night in your shed? I guess it's pottery shed. And the potter said, certainly it's all right. However, I've already allowed another mendicant, another renunciant, to spend the night in the shed. And I think you'd have to ask him if it was okay with him, if he will share it with you. So the Buddha went into the shed, and there, in fact, was this man who was traveling across India to find the Buddha. And the Buddha asked him, would it be okay, could we share the shed for the night? And the man said, sure, certainly. And so the Buddha came in, and as night descended, they both sat up and meditated through much of the night. And the Buddha was quite impressed by this other man who was meditating and sitting so well and into the middle, late into the night. So he finally asked, the Buddha finally asked him, whose teachings do you follow and under who have you been ordained as a mendicant? And this man, his name is Pukkusati. Pukkusati said, well, I haven't yet been ordained, but I'm following the teachings of the Buddha, and I'm off to see him to be ordained. And the Buddha said, oh, so you've never seen the Buddha? Nope. So you wouldn't recognize him if you saw him, would you? No. So then the Buddha said, he didn't reveal who he was, but he said, I will teach you the Dhamma. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend, said Venerable Pukkasati. And then the Buddha said as follows. The Buddha started off with the teaching that probably, if it went into it in great detail, would all put you all to sleep. But actually, it's quite profound what he had to teach. And as he went through it, this teaching, it goes through some what could be seen kind of like dry philosophy or dry kind of explanations to some things which are characteristically almost mystical in how they are for this kind of literature. So here's one. I'll give you a taste of a little bit more kind of. So the key word here is that the Bhikkhu Bodhi translates is conceiving. Conceiving is kind of thinking about things, speculating, having opinions about things, conceiving, thinking, speculating. By overcoming all conceivings, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. The sage at peace is not shaken and is not agitated. For there is nothing present in such a sage that can be born. Not being born, how could that person age? Not aging, how could that person die? Not dying, how could that person be shaken? Not being shaken, how could that person be agitated? So, you know, this is kind of unusual, kind of, you know, a sage at peace is someone who doesn't die. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Or maybe not. So what does that mean? Certainly, this you know, the Buddha, that doesn't mean that literally, that not going to die. But how is it that someone becomes a sage who has a profound experience of peace, and it would be accurate to say, that person would not be is not born, does not age, does not die. Often it's said that's one of the great insights of Buddhism, that everybody ages, gets sick, and dies. So here it says this doesn't happen. So that's a little kind of. So what is the teaching that leads up to this? So it begins. So the Buddha, they're sitting there. So imagine this potter shed. And they've been meditating together through the night. It's probably still dark. And this is what the Buddha has to say. This person. So this is an interesting, to use the word this person. Here, Pukkasati doesn't recognize the Buddha as the Buddha yet. So he's thinking, so the Buddha is going to introduce himself. As this person, I suppose himself, right? This person consists of six elements, six bases of contact, and 18 kinds of mental experiences, and four different determinations, resolves. So instead of saying, well, I'm the Buddha, that's who I am. He describes himself in very impersonal terms. And then he goes on and says, and this is a great little expression, that the way the Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated it, at least. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands on these resolves. So the tides of conceiving, see these big tides coming in and sweeps everything away. Some of the rivers, big rivers, when the tide comes in, it's really dramatic. It's kind of this big wave, so kind of comes up. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands on these. So conceivings of the mind, the thoughts, the opinions, speculations that you have can be so strong and so powerful, it's like a powerful current that can sweep you away, washes over you. It's probably all of you have had some experience of being swept away or caught up in swirls and whirlpools of thoughts. Sometimes, you know, whirlpools that just pull you down, or big waves or currents that kind of sweeps you far away from where you are. So the tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these four resolves. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over such a person, the person is called a sage at peace. So here he's going to list these four resolves that for a sage of peace. One should not neglect wisdom. One should preserve truth. One should cultivate relinquishment. One should train in peace. So four resolves, four things that someone who wants to be peaceful or is peaceful is committed to. And this is kind of the inspiration for giving this teaching today, because yesterday's teacher, Gregory Kramer, reminded me of this teaching, of these four resolves. To be resolved upon wisdom, to be resolved upon truth, to be resolved upon letting go, and to be resolved upon peace. So if you want to be a kind of person who doesn't get swept away and caught up in the worlds of your thinking, abstract thinking, conceptions, and all that, there's something about these four qualities of mind that can protect you from that. So wisdom, truth, letting go, and peace. You can be committed to them. And I think not so many people are committed to these four. It doesn't occur to people to be committed to peace that often. And a lot of people would rather not be committed to letting go. And then to be committed to truth. A lot of people, there's a fair number of people who kind of feel a real commitment to being truthful, but not enough people. And then the Buddha, this is the kind of lays out this little brief little teaching. So this is who I am, he says. I'm just these elements, made up of elements in contact. And if you want to be someone who's at peace, these are the things you should be determined by. Over and over again, you find the teachings of the Buddha that he doesn't give emphasis to doctrine or creed as being the foundation of what he has to teach, but rather qualities of mind, practices or dedications of how you live your life. And here he is again. He says, you know, wisdom, he says, so one does not neglect wisdom, one preserves truth, one cultivates letting go, and one trains in peace. So then he goes on to explain what he means by the elements. And I'd like to read them backwards. I think they're more interesting, the list. So there's kind of five or six called elements, or properties or something, and that make up kind of the human person. And the first one I'll refer to is called space. The space element. The space element may be either inside of you or outside. What is the internal space element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to, that is, the holes of the ears, the nostrils, the door of the mouth, and that aperture whereby what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets swallowed, and where it collects, and whereby it is excreted from below, or wherever else internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial. Isn't that nice? How much space do you have inside of there? So you can imagine lots of places where they're kind of space. It's, you know, lots of room for things to happen. The food goes down. Sometimes I feel like I have too much space in my head. Sometimes it feels like I have great, wonderful space in my head. But anyway, all this space. So we have space, so recognize we have some. You know, so inside this bounded body, there's places where there's space. And then it gets interesting. Whatever space there is simply the element of space, or the property of space. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom, as follows. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the space element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the space element. So probably most of you are not particularly entranced in the spell of the promise of space and attached to it. So if you probably don't need to get disenchanted. But this movement in Buddhism is very important, the idea that whatever you're in the spell of, whatever you're caught in the trance, that you think it has all this promise that's going to make you happy and make your life and create a strong identity. Part of the function of Buddhist practice is to see that whatever you're in the trance of is not worth being entranced in. You kind of see through the magic of the magic show. So and the wonderful analogy, I think, of the magic show, you know, I think some people can watch a magic trick over and over and over again, and it's pretty interesting until the magician shows you how it's done, and then it's no longer interesting. You know, then you're ready to go. So the magic of attachment, the magic of our clinging that we have. So the space element, so that which is space inside of us, don't take that which is space inside of us who you really are. Pretty straightforward, right? I mean, probably most of you don't take your apertures as yourself, as your true self. Then to go backwards, the air element. The air element, so this is what he's doing now. He's just starting to lay out all the different things that make up who you are. And the question is, as you go through this and kind of put this aside, imagine you're putting these different parts aside, who really are you? What's left to be you? So now we've taken aside the space, right? Then the air element. The air element may be either internal or external. What is the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, that is, upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs, in-breath and out-breath, and whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and air, and air, and airy. And so you got that? Some of you will fart. Some of you will have air and gas kind of bubbling through your stomach. And then they have this idea that, you know, that's in the ancient world, that somehow if there's movement, whatever is moving in your body is kind of the air element that makes it move. They don't think they were thinking like muscles like we do, but just some of the air element. So if you feel movement in your body, that movement is the air element. Now, this should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. So this is very important. This is a kind of teaching that the Buddha repeats often. He identifies the things which are not mine, and not myself. And so the air element, when you have gas, I mean, no one else is having gas, so it's kind of yours, but. But is it really, you know, is that really who you are, your gas inside of you? It's not really who you are, right? I mean, that's just maybe some food went in there or different physiological, biological things were going on. And so there's this thing that happens. And if we identify it as mine, if we take it as, you know, this is who I am, it can be quite embarrassing to be. But, you know, really it's not, you know. It's not really who we really are. It's just kind of associated with us. So, you know, we kind of put it aside. This is not what we are. So you know, we become disenchanted with the air element within us, all the things that can be identified as the air element. This is not myself. Disenchanted, as we become disenchanted, this movement of dispassion. Dispassion here doesn't mean, it means it's actually a good thing to be dispassion in this ancient language. It means you're no longer clinging or addicted in some powerful way to things. You following okay? So now we've put aside two parts of who you are. You know, this kind of makes up this thing that we are all about, space and air. And then we have the fire element. The fire element may be either internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever internally is fire and fiery. That is, that by which one is warmed, ages, and is consumed. And that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested. And whatever else internally belongs to oneself is fire and fiery. So, so you can get warm, right? Some people say the fire element includes when you're cold, but the fire element is whatever keeps you warm. And also, this, you know, it's what the fire that burns your food, digests your food. And so, you know, sometimes when we get, you know, you want to identify the temporary experience of being hot or a temporary experience of digesting your food. Is that who you really are? Is that what it is? The temperature you experience? The hot flashes, is that who you really are? I remember my wife when she was, I suppose she was in her, I don't know, mid-30s. She had to have an operation, and so to prepare her for the operation, they gave her, for 30 days, or I forget how long, medically induced menopause. And so temporary menopause, reversible. And I remember she kind of thinks, well, she had experiences during that time, and she said, this is not me. So are you really your heat when you get hot? Are you really the digestion, your food? Are those who you really are? No. Don't take it as me, myself, and mine. You put that aside. And then there's the water element. The water element is defined as whatever is water, watery, that is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, urine, whatever else internally belongs to oneself is water, watery. So I think you have some of those things. And now these should be seen with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So do you really want to kind of closely identify as your true metaphysical self or your true identity, your snot, your spit? So the water is whatever has fluid within us. So what this tradition is doing is taking, and the modern world, especially how we define these elements, is the elements are dividing up everything we can experience physically in these categories. So if you put aside the concepts of your body, the ideas you have of a body, but just stay in touch with what you actually sense and feel of your body, like if you close your eyes, then the particular sensations that you have, immediate physical sensations, can be put in the Buddhist tradition, they kind of want to class in these categories called the elements. And there's no physical sensation which is outside of these classifications. So this is kind of classifying all physical experience of who we are. And as you start teasing it apart this way, the idea is you don't see, well, now that I tease it apart, just like snot or being warm, that makes up my experience, rather than kind of creating a gestalt picture of this is me. You see, actually, these different parts that make up so-called me, these are not myself. These can't be. And there's one more element left here. The earth element. The earth element is whatever is solid, solidified, that is. So listen to this and see if any of these lists qualifies as, you know, you really want to take on as your identity. Or do you usually identify with this? And like someone asks, who are you? And you hold up these, this is who I am, my true self. Do you attach to this in some kind of as your identity? Me, myself, and mine? Some of them people do, but head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery. I don't know what that mesentery is. Maybe I have it. contents of the stomach, feces, and whatever else internally belong is solid and solidified. So it's, you know, it's quite something to, you know, cut your fingernails or something and look at the fingernail clippings on this counter of the sink. Is that you? What happened there? You know, or to cut your hair and, you know, and then it's on the floor. You're now on the floor? Is that you? So these more solid things, you know, also to see it with wisdom, this is not myself, not mine, not the true self. Okay? So the movement here is to see these different parts of our physical being and not identify, not be caught by this is my true self, this is who I am. And we know that some people do identify with their body quite strongly. Some people spend more time fixing their hair than you know, preparing their hair for the public than they prepare what they're going to say. Because, you know, it's so important how you look. But here, you know, to somehow step back and get disenchanted, not because it's kind of being dismissive of it, so we don't cling to it, so we don't have this kind of addiction to it, and so that we can learn how to be at peace. So we're not caught up in the tides of conceiving, swept away. So I hope you're with me enough. Okay? So after putting all these different parts aside nicely, what's left? What's left, what the Buddha says what's left, is consciousness. There remains only consciousness purified and bright. So isn't that nice? So if you're not identified with all these different pieces of your body, what's left is consciousness purified and bright. And if with consciousness there, what one consciousness cognizes things. And here he describes one of the core things that consciousness cognizes. It cognizes whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. So a basic human experience. So now we're talking about not physical experience, the sensations, but the tone, the feeling tone, the hedonic tone, you know, whether it feels good or doesn't feel good. Feels nice, doesn't feel nice. Painful or not painful. Painful or pleasant. The tremendous amount of human life is wrapped up around, are things pleasant or unpleasant? So if one sees, so then, as one stays here, what he describes next is if you look carefully at your pleasant experience you have, the unpleasant sensations, feelings you have, that they're temporary. They don't last very long. They come and they go. Some, if you're very attentive, you can actually watch them kind of flicker in and out of existence as you're there. If you're not so concentrated, it might take minutes, hours, or days sometimes for certain sensations to come and go. But they come and go, they come and go. And if one understands like this, that the sensations come and go, that means that sense that the feelings come and go, these feeling tones, pleasant, unpleasant, come and go, then a person is likely to become equanimous about them, not to be so caught up in them. And this movement of becoming equanimous is very important for cultivating a mind which can get liberated, become free. A mind that's not equanimous is caught up, is reacting, is for and against things. But to have a mind which is not caught up in for and against, it learns to let the pleasant and unpleasant experiences of life come through, kind of like the weather passing through. I've been in places where they said, if you don't like the weather here, just wait 5 minutes. And it's kind of like when I lived in Hawaii. When I first moved to Hawaii, I'd never been this kind of that kind of climate. And the first time we had a torrential downpour walking down the street, for me it was like, oh my God, this is serious. I better run for cover and hide and get out of the rain. And it didn't take very long to realize you don't have to do that in Hawaii. because the downpours come, they're there for a few minutes, then they stop. And then it's hot in Hawaii, so you dry out quickly. So, you can be equanimous about the weather coming and going. You know, it's like, let it rain, Let it not rain, it's all okay. if you really had a clear sense of how much your mind reacts to the things because they're pleasant or unpleasant, how a big part of human life is made up of that, And then you can appreciate that if you see the impermanent, flowing, inconstant nature of it, that how that might lead to kind of the mind kind of opening up, relaxing, becoming equanimous. As the mind becomes more, so you put aside the physical identification with the body as the self, looking at the mind itself, one of the primary things the mind does is it's trying to take care of you. And one of the ways it takes care of you is it kind of tunes into what's pleasant and unpleasant in the moment, here. There might be, so if you're not going to be caught up in thoughts about the future, abstract ideas about the past, and really stay here for this experience now, one of the primary things the mind does is to tune into the pleasant and unpleasant. If the mind becomes wise about the nature of pleasant and unpleasant, it has the opportunity of becoming equanimous. Deep equanimity is considered one of the crown jewels of Buddhist spirituality. It's a beautiful thing. It's not indifference. So then, as a person settles into a mind which is relaxed and equanimous, the Buddha says, if you realize that the mind that's equanimous is itself a composite thing, is made up of conditioned things. It's not a permanent, everlasting thing. Then it's possible to, well, so let me see what he says. Then, realizing that even the mind of equanimity doesn't qualify as a self, it's not something to cling to or want, it's a conditioned phenomenon, then one does not form any condition or generate any interest or intentions towards either being or non-being. One doesn't no longer gets concerned with trying to with ideas of existence or non-existence, becoming something or not becoming something. So the mind gets so peaceful and quiet, it does not try to make something happen or trying to make something not happen or unmake something. If you watch your mind carefully and see what it's about, it's mostly trying to accomplish something, think about something, figure something out, plan something, remember something. It often has a plan, trying to do something. It's remarkable how much of the thinking of the mind has to do with you as the main character. Somehow it's self-relating. It's because, it's how the mind is trying to take care of yourself and take care of the world. And in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with it, but to be caught in that, it doesn't really provide you with deep abiding peace. And remember, this text is talking about how to not be swept up in the tides of conceiving. So with this equanimity as a foundation, one then steps back in a sense even more and has a quiet, settled mind. There's no longer driven by interest or intentions. Not once and for all, not forever, but at least, in meditation or someplace. It's very peaceful, settled, still mind. I can imagine that as the Buddha is teaching this to Pukkasati, in the potter's shed, in the middle of the night, dark outside still, the Buddha might have paused as he talked about this kind of mind. And remember, Pukkasati had been meditating through the night. So he was probably pretty still and quiet. And to kind of get a sense, a feeling, a kind of sense, or feel close by, or maybe even go into a mind which is so still, so still, so at home in itself, so content, so not involved in making something happen, wanting something to happen, just there. We say in English sometimes, just being. Since such a person does not form any condition or generate any interest or intention towards either existence or non-existence, the person does not cling to anything in this world. And when one does not cling, one is not agitated. When one is not agitated, one personally attains nirvana. So that's nice. When one does not cling, one is not agitated. Isn't that an interesting equation? Is that true, that every time you're agitated, it's because you're clinging to something? Or do you manage to get agitated without clinging to anything? And when one is not agitated, one personally attains nirvana. That sounds pretty easy. That's what nirvana is, just don't be agitated. That sounds nice. So, remember this book. The whole discussion is based on this idea of not being swept away by the tides of conceiving. Buddha says he's going to describe what conceiving is. This kind of speculation, these thoughts, these ideas, these concepts that people get caught up and live in. So listen to the kind of so. This is the list or how he describes the conceiving that he's concerned with, that he wants people to come free of. And so he has in quotation marks, I am is a conceiving. I am this is a conceiving. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. I shall be possessed of form is a conceiving. I shall be formless is a conceiving. I shall be conscious is a conceiving. I shall be non-conscious is a conceiving. Conceiving is a disease. Conceiving is a tumor. Conceiving is a dart. By overcoming all conceivings, one is called a bhikkhu at peace, a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. So the conceiving that we get swept away in here are all, he described all conceivings that have to do with self-identity issue. Who I'm going to be, what I'm going to be. So even the idea that I am, such an innocent thing. For some people it's kind of ultimate, the feeling of emness, I am. But even that, to think that way, conceive that way, is agitating, is extra, involves some kind of clinging. And then things like, I am this, I am X. Anytime you want to make, anytime you're involved in a statement about yourself that could be expressed, I am this, is a conceiving, is thoughts, is ideas, which could sweep you away if you get really attached or involved in those kinds. And is there, you know, but isn't it reasonable to think of yourself as, I am this, I am a man, I am a woman? I mean, what's the Buddha's problem? You know, it's such an obvious thing. There's nothing wrong with being usually a man or a woman, but to think that way, it's very easy to get swept away in the tides of conceiving. There's all these ideas of what we have about what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, and those can be challenged and upset, and all kinds of things can happen, and we get swept away and feel embarrassed or upset or angry or all kinds of things based on that. It's possible to be alive, conscious, without having any reference point, any thought about oneself as a man or a woman. Just, you know, it's not like you stop being a man or woman, it's just the mind's not thinking that way, not conceiving that way. So with anything, any statement at all, I am this, is a conceiving. I shall be, so concerned about what we're going to be in the future, And I think what it involves also here in the ancient Indian world, people were thinking about, I'm going to be something in my next life. I'm going to be reborn. Like, that's what I'm going to be in the future. People were thinking about the future, and being reborn was a big strategy of the ancient religious world. I shall not be is for the atheists. You know, well, I'm not going to be reborn. That's not going to happen. I don't believe in this rebirth thing. That's also a conceiving. What's left? If you're not going to, you know, if you can't believe you're going to be reborn, you can't believe you're not going to be reborn, what's left? What's left? You don't think those things. You don't conceive. You just don't, you're just present and alive and engaged in this world without those kinds of thoughts. And then I shall be formless. I shall be conscious. I shall have form. I think also implies, you know, in the next lifetime, like, I'll be this way. So, to not be involved in conceiving, to not be involved with creating, living in ideas and thoughts about, I am this, this is mine, this is my true self, it can be a tremendous relief. It's not necessary. And at least sometimes in your life, hopefully you have the experience of putting it all down. And that's part of the function of meditation, is to be a place in your life where it's safe to put down things that maybe in other situations are fine to have. It's fine to have certain concepts and live by them. But to have the experience. I don't know, it keeps coming to my mind now, so I apologize since I kept saying, I can't say this. But it was like Groucho Marx who said, told the woman who had, 13 kids or something. He was kind of amazed how many children she said, and she asked why. She said, well, I love my husband. And he said, I love my cigar too, but sometimes I take it out. So I apologize for that. But, you know, so your conceivings, all your concepts, you can love your concepts, but sometimes put them down and have the ability to put them down. Do you have the ability? It's very humbling to sit down in meditation and realize you don't. You sit down, your mind just keeps thinking and churning away. But the training is to learn how to put them down or not be caught by them, and not be caught by this world of conceiving. So Pukkasati heard all this, and then he understood. Thereupon, Venerable Pukkasati thought, indeed, the teacher has come to me. The Buddha is here. Then he rose, arranged his upper robe and shoulder, bowed with his head to the Buddha, and said, Venerable Sir, a fault overcame me in that, being confused, I addressed the Buddha as friend. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One forgive my transgression, seen as such for the sake of my restraint in the future. The Buddha responds, surely, Bhikkhu, a transgression overcame you in that you, being confused, presume to address me as friend. But since you see your transgression as such and make amends in accordance with the Dhamma, you are forgiven. For it is growth in the Noble One's discipline when one sees one's transgression as such, makes amends in accordance with the Dhamma, undertakes restraint in the future. Venerable Sir, I would like to receive full ordination as a monastic under the Buddha. But are your bowls and robes complete? Because you can't really become a mendicant, fully ordained as a mendicant, unless you have these, you own almost nothing, but you're supposed to have a robe and you're supposed to have a bowl. So Pukkasati said, no, I don't. Well, you should go out and get one. Get them. So he goes off to get them. He rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Buddha, he departed in order to search for a bowl and robe. Then, while searching for a bowl and robe, a stray cow killed him. That's quite something. This is how the story more or less ends. But then they come back to the Buddha, and it said, this is what happened. And the Buddha said this about him. Pukkasati was wise. He practiced in accordance to the Dhamma, and he did not trouble me in the interpretation of the Dhamma. With the destruction of the five lower fetters, the five lower attachments, Pukkasati has reappeared in the pure abodes and will attain final nirvana there without ever returning to that world. So in other words, in this early Buddhist tradition, he attained a very high level of attainment. So to become free of conceiving, where you do not age, you're not born, you're not die. Aging is a concept. It's real, I mean, in a sense, but what's the reality of aging apart from your thinking about it? What happens when you don't think about it? I've known people who've died. I remember a man who died who was so anxious that he would die in the wrong way because he had cancer. He went out and got all these books on death and dying so he would do it right. You were lucky to live in a modern age where you have manuals and explain how, because people have been doing it for millennia and they've been doing it successfully, I think, but you know. But he felt like he had to learn how to do it. But in fact, what happened was that as he got close, his anxiety disappeared. It was clear he was going to die. All his anxiety disappeared. And in that profound peace that he was, it's like death didn't exist anymore. There was no death. Death is just a concept, an idea. A friend of mine who had AIDS, a famous quote he made, Ihsan Dorsey, he said, to have AIDS is to be alive. He would say with his sparkly, peaceful eyes. And so aging, dying and death as concepts that we relate to and get caught up in and think about have no more reality than taking watercolors and painting a picture on a moving stream. So if you don't relate to it as solid and fixed, can your mind step back from conceiving, from concepts and ideas? Relax, settle, become peaceful, be at ease. And the way to do that, in this amazing text that he talks about, is you need to have certain determinations, certain resolves, commitments. Committed to wisdom, committed to truth, committed to letting go, and committed to peace. Are they great things? So, thank you. Look up and down the street, make sure there's no cows. And thank you.